KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in this neighborhood, the Haight-Ashbury District.
I live in NOPA.
Vernal Heights.
The Richmond.
I live in the Panhandle.
Coming up, election results are pretty much all finalized. So what's next for California and the Bay Area?
Counties need to finalize the results by December 7th, and then the Secretary of State has another week to certify results.
What it means when the Golden State turns almost completely blue. Then we'll hear the story of a man sentenced to life in prison who dreams of living off the land.
I have this longing to be connected with nature.
And the story of a historic haven for bohemian rhapsodies.
After these bohemian poetry readings in North Beach, everybody would converge on the mountain.
That's all coming up today on Cross Currents. Stick around. With devastating fires and the dramatic start of the rainy season making headlines, it's hard to remember that we voted in the midterm elections only 3 weeks ago. We know now that Democrats dominated in California, and many changes are going to take place at local and statewide levels. And to break it down, we have with us KALW's election coordinator, Angela Johnston, and news director, Ben Trefney. We invited them back into the studio to talk about what is new. Hey, guys.
Hi.
All right. So a lot has happened since Election Day, but the votes aren't really finalized. Ben, give us the details about that.
Yeah, you might think it's all wrapped up, but it's not quite there yet. Counties need to finalize the results by December 7th, and then the Secretary of State has another week to certify those results.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all about the local races and measures. For state senators and assembly members, the California Constitution states their term is going to commence on Monday.
You look that up.
Yeah, it's Article 4, Section 2.
Angela, what about federal officials?
Yeah, federal officials, that's U.S. senators and representatives. They'll start their terms on January 3rd.
Okay, so we know in the big picture, Democrats have taken back the House of Representatives. Just today, Nancy Pelosi was nominated by House Democrats to be the Speaker, though that won't really be determined until January, right?
Right, yeah, the whole House will vote at that point.
Right. And also today, Barbara Lee narrowly lost her bid to be the first woman to lead the House Democratic Caucus.
Mm-hmm.
And over the last few weeks, we've been watching a lot of the races to the South, and they almost all turned to Democrats, right, Ange?
Yes, and there's actually one that's still undecided. It's the only undecided race left in the country.
Mm.
California's 21st District, it's near the San Joaquin Valley, and it includes areas of Fresno County and others in the Central Valley. It's three-quarters Hispanic and voted for Hillary Clinton back in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
But the Republican incumbent, David Valadao, has been in office there for three terms. On election night, he had a big lead, and some networks were quick to declare him a winner.
And he was quick to declare himself
right.
a winner, too.
Mm-hmm. But fast forward 3 weeks later, and his Democratic challenger, T.J. Cox, has taken the lead. That's after counting thousands of mail-in ballots. Those mm-hmm. are typically Democratic. As of this conversation, he's still in the lead.
Okay. Any other close races?
Well, the state superintendent of public instruction was also really close.
Uh-huh.
So early on, Marshall Tuck, he's a former charter school executive, took the lead. But when votes kept coming in after election night, Tony Thurmond kept gaining points and he's declared victory.
Mm-hmm.
So since the superintendent of public instruction doesn't have a lot of power on their own, Thurmond needs to have a good relationship with the governor. And he and Governor-elect Gavin Newsom are aligned, both backed by the teachers' unions and the Democratic Party.
Okay, so both of those candidates for head of education were Democrats, and that was the case for other races as well, like the U.S. Senate, where Dianne Feinstein held off Kevin DeLeon by about 10 percentage points, Ben.
Right, that was part of this blue wave that the media really likes to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on the final results in District 21, which we just spoke about, only 7 or 8 of the state's 53 House seats will be filled by Republicans,
uh-huh.
just 7 or 8 of them. And every single statewide office in California was won by a Democrat.
Mm.
Yeah, Democrats are, according to the Sacramento Bee, on pace to control 3/4 of the state assembly. And this hasn't been done since, guess when?
When?
1883.
1883. Mm. Okay, what does that mean then?
The supermajorities could mean that Democrats could approve more tax increases or put constitutional amendments on the ballot without being challenged by Republican votes.
Yeah, they're not even going to come close to being challenged by Republican votes. And that's going to be really interesting with somebody who's proven himself to be more progressive politically in the governor's seat, at least on social causes. And I am really, really curious to see what Governor-elect Newsom does with this office. This is a guy who challenged the state Supreme Court on same-sex marriage. He's been ahead of social trends like cannabis legalization and gun control, and he has been a backer of single-payer health care. And that's going to be really interesting now that he has this position of power with Democrats backing him everywhere he looks. I think it's going to be the most fascinating story of the coming year and maybe for longer than that.
Mm-hmm. Former Mayor Gavin Newsom. Mm-hmm. We know him really well
and
here.
Former city supervisor.
That's right. That's right. So let's talk about what else is changing, and we'll start with the state propositions. Taking a look at the Secretary of State's website, so we've got Prop 1, 2, 4, 7, 11, and 12 passed.
Yeah, quite a few.
What does that mean?
Well, the first three you mentioned, 1, 2, and 4, all have to do with bonds. Mm-hmm. Californians typically seem to support bond measures, and showed in this election. The approval rate for bond measures is actually 90%. Mm. So every bond measure on the ballot has been approved since 2014. That's with the exception of Proposition 3, which was the big water bond that did not pass this November.
Right.
And when I was going over my ballot with friends before I voted, one of them kept asking, how does our bond load affect our debt? And so I looked it up. The legislative analyst said the total cost to pay off the three general obligation bonds that were on the ballot this year would be $26 billion, resulting in an average cost of $650 million per year for the next 40 years. That's significantly more than the state currently spends from the general fund on its bond debt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the proposition that passed that I'm most interested in is Proposition 12. That's about animal confinement. And it's going to require bigger pens for all egg-laying chickens, for breeding pigs, and for baby cows, or veal, as they call it in restaurants. Ag folks say this is going to raise costs, which makes sense, and those prices are going to get passed on to consumers. So it's possible, actually, that while voters pass that law to make sure animals are treated more humanely, it might end up having this added effect of reducing animal consumption. We'll see how much economics affect people's eating habits.
That's an interesting one.
Yeah.
All right, what about local races?
Okay, so even though Libby Schaaf took the lead early on election night in the Oakland mayoral race, a few of her competitors didn't give up until only recently. That's after all the votes were counted. Schaaf got about 50% of the vote, and Brooks got about 25. She only conceded a week ago, and she wrote, "Though I conceded the race, I did not concede our movement. We are just beginning."
Mm-hmm. And just to the north there, I wanted to talk about a result that did not get as much coverage on election night. It's Berkeley, which elected a 22-year-old to its city council. That's barely older than my kids. It's kind of hard to think about. Rigel Robinson ran to represent District 7 less than a year after graduating from UC Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And the council member he's replacing, Chris Worthington, he served exactly 22 years. So he's been in office for as long as Robinson's been alive. So the youngster was actually Worthington's pick, and it was a runaway, which maybe isn't such a big surprise. Berkeley actually reset its districts in 2013 after census calculations, and now District 7 includes the main portion of Berkeley's campus. That made the vast majority of voters around the same age as Robinson. So, hey, there's representation for you.
Representation, democracy. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Angela Johnston is KALW's election coordinator, and Ben Trefney is our news director. Find more at KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. And now a story from KALW's radio class at Solano State Prison in Vacaville. The incarcerated men there record interviews and edit them into short pieces that we play for you here on KALW.
This is Uncuffed.
Stories from Solano State Prison.
Doing time in prison, a person can often lose hope. But that's not the case for Aaron Daria. He has plans to start a ranch once he's paroled. Uncuffed producer Joe Kirk sat down with Aaron to ask him about his dream.
I first met Aaron Daria a little over a year ago in a moment of confusion. Another inmate had mistaken me for Aaron. The funny thing is Aaron is Filipino and I'm of Nordic descent. We had a good laugh about it and instantly became friends. Over time, Aaron told me about his dream of being a rancher, and I got really interested in it. So I sat down with Aaron to ask him a few questions about his big dream and his plans for the future. So the whole thing I wanted to interview you about is that you have this big dream that you have when you're going to get out.
Mm.
And that dream is that you want to own a ranch. That's correct?
Or I surely do.
All right.
I would love to be a stockman.
And so how did you even get into the whole idea of having a ranch?
Well, I would say because of my descent and my upbringing, being around a lot of Filipinos, and my father, who's passed away in 2009, he was born on a ranch. And I've heard of stories from my uncle and my father about growing up in the mountains in the Philippines, Sambales Carao. Okay. You know, shout out going out to the folks out in the Philippines. But I have this longing. I have this longing to be connected with nature.
Have you ever been on a farm or a ranch?
Yeah. I buried my grandfather 88, 87, sometime around there. And I got a chance to visit the Philippines for the first time. And I seen how life was, and it was definitely a culture shock.
What does your family think about this idea of a ranch?
My mother completely supports it. She completely supports it. She believes in my dream and my idea of being connected with nature and just having a way of life that's, I would say, slow, in contrast to San Francisco and, you know, that fast-paced, busy 7x7 1.3 million people, crowded life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this whole thing, this isn't a pipe dream either. This is something that can actually happen for you. Like, you have the financial means to do so and everything.
Oh, definitely so. You know, being that San Francisco is considered a hyper real estate market.
Yeah.
I'm fortunate that that my parents were able to buy property in San Francisco over there on next to Amazon, Crocker Amazon Park, McLaren Park. And the property there is going up.
Do you plan on going at this project alone, or do you plan on getting some help, like a ranch hand or somebody that has knowledge of a ranch? Do you plan on getting help?
Well, I've looked into different avenues. You know, of course, I feel I feel confident that I can tackle this task. You know, I was built for it physically. You know, I'm trying to prepare myself. However, I know that a lot of my mistakes in the past have been because I haven't asked for help. So I think that if the opportunity is available, I would ask for help.
And so you're very familiar with a lot of different things. You've read a lot of books on it. And I understand you're very interested in pasture and different types of grasses and things like that.
Sure am. Yeah, I learned about Timothy grass, red clover, Kentucky bluegrass, alfalfa, the difference between legume and grass. The clippings, how many times a year, wow. Moisture content, the thickness of the grass, and how much grass you need to actually pasture cattle.
So you really studied.
Yeah. I don't want to keep a cow locked up in some stock pan, and, you know, I know what that feels like. I know what that feels like. So I think for a cattle to be able to graze is a beautiful idea. And I know that there's a point where there's selfishness, and, you know, there's some ranchers here that might not be so humane to the animals.
Is there anything that you plan on doing with your ranch or your farm to put back into society? You ever thought about that?
Yeah, I would like to teach stockmanship also as I get the hang of it. Marie Coronado, who is very close to me, she has expressed the desire to help give back to children out of juvenile halls, because I was tried as an adult.
Yeah, you were a child.
I was 16 years old when everything happened. I was 17 years old when I was incarcerated. And she's expressed the desire that, hey, you know, why don't you give back to kids like you? By teaching them to be connected with nature, especially a child that might be lost and confused and dealing with the struggles of dysfunctional family life and a dysfunctional home, that being able to be connected to the land and just not all of this concrete and steal would help show people what life is about.
That was Aaron Daria, an inmate at Solano State Prison. He spoke with Joe Kirk, who produced that interview and who is also incarcerated. KALW's radio training program at Solano State Prison is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. All content is approved by an information officer, and you can listen to more at kalw.org/uncuffed. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hena Baba. A nearly forgotten landmark in the Bay Area got some well-deserved recognition earlier this month. The place is called Druid Heights. It's a former bohemian escape in the backwoods of Marin County. The Cultural Landscape Foundation recently added it to its list of at-risk landscapes in the hopes of protecting it. So what is Druid Heights? Well, it once attracted big celebrities and personalities like Alan Watts, the famous philosopher who helped introduce Buddhism to Western culture.
There was a young prince by the name of Gautama Siddhartha who became the man we call the Buddha.
And one of Druid Heights' residents was the famous feminist Margot St. James. But the person who was the real force behind Druid Heights remains mostly anonymous. In this story from our archives, KLW's Judy Silber brings us the story of that man and the magical getaway he created.
National Park Service spokesperson Alexandra Pikovet grimaces as we bump down an unmarked, steep dirt road.
I really dislike this road. And I've lived in really backcountry areas, and I still really dislike this road.
We're lucky. It's a clear day. In the rain, Pikovet refuses to drive this road, which is the only access to a property fancifully dubbed Druid Heights.
We're gonna walk a ways and through mud and gunk to get there.
We're not too far from Muir Woods National Monument. The federal government owns this land, too, but it's not listed on any map. Pikovet and I walk beneath towering eucalyptus trees and Monterey pine. In the distance, we see amber rolling hills unspotted by development. After crossing a grass meadow, we reach an abandoned house. Its long, swooping roof reminds me of a Chinese dragon boat. The inside reminds me of different creatures.
The new inhabitants of this house have four legs and long tails. There's lots of mouse droppings here. But what we've just walked into is the bath and shower. This bath and shower has bright orange tiles throughout, and the woodwork is really uniquely done.
The architect of this house was Roger Summers, a white-haired, white-bearded man with an irrepressible appetite for life. In the mid-1950s, he convinced gay poetess Elsa Gidlow to buy the property, 5 acres for $10,000. She named the place, he fixed it up, but he often cared more for design than building codes. In this house, large panes of glass tenuously support the roof. In the center of the main room, there's a table, sunk about 4 feet into the ground.
It is actually down almost at floor level, so that when you sit at the dining table, really only the upper part of your back and your head would be visible to someone from outside of the building, because you're down inside a pit.
It's odd, for sure. But thanks to Summer's eccentricities, this house and the rest of Druid Heights was a hub of Bay Area cultural, spiritual, and artistic exploration. Parties, poetry readings, and jam sessions included some of the Bay Area's most celebrated intellectuals, musicians, and artists. Beat inspiration Kenneth Rexroth held court at the Sunken Table, engaged in animated late-night discussions.
Lying under the stars in the summer night late while the autumn constellations climb the sky.
Poet Gary Snyder lived on the grounds for a year.
Half asleep on the cold grass, night rain flicking the maples.
And rumors have it that Allen Ginsberg, Tom Robbins, and Lily Tomlin all hung out.
To me, the term sexual freedom meant freedom from having to have sex. And then along came Good Vibrations.
Druid Heights is connotes an air of mystery and awe in the redwoods up on the mountain.
Colin Farish arrived at Druid Heights in 1995, long after its heyday.
And I think it just helped people relax and feel safe up there to be themselves, and Roger encouraged that at every turn.
Summers told him many stories, most of which he won't divulge, but he told me some.
They used to host the most amazing parties after these bohemian poetry readings in North Beach. Everybody would converge on the mountain. And the stories are legendary of they were riding horses naked in the moonlight and playing music all night long. And the jazz clubs would let out, and Dizzy Gillespie and all kinds of fantastic musicians would continue the party up at Rogers.
Jam sessions would last late into the night, with Summers on his saxophone or congas.
He had a huge curvilinear closet filled with costumes and outrageous outfits. And nothing quite gets a party going like a wild white beard maniac playing drums and flirting with women, all the women. With so much energy, just kind of made everybody else pale in comparison.
Philosopher Alan Watts recorded an album called This Is It in 1962.
And then he begins to stand aside from the one that looks and criticizes and criticizes that, and so on and so on and so on.
The recording, which features Roger Summers and other friends, contrasts with Watts' more serious radio broadcast about Zen Buddhism.
Now, the word Buddha is not a proper name, it's a title.
Ed Stiles is one of the few remaining residents at Druid Heights. And he says Watts could be found on the property carrying a large wizard-like staff in the woods or spouting dirty limericks at parties.
Roger was far and away the most playful adult I've ever known. And Alan had that streak in him, too. Perhaps that's how they were friends.
Stiles is a woodworker, like Summers. And the two met back in 1961, when Stiles was 22. He moved in 4 years later.
I was having more fun than I think I'd ever had in my life, probably. It was unpredictable. It was sporadic. You just never knew what you'd find.
The Eagles, the Steve Miller Band, and the Doobie Brothers all played at Druid Heights. Summers also built a touring bus for Neil Young. In true Summers style, it was an elaborate piece of art. In the 70s, Stiles tells me, more hardcore drugs came to Druid Heights, and that caused a schism in the community. Eventually, that element left. Through many of the years that followed, the property remained an unpredictable alternative scene, until Summers passed away in 2001. He was in his hot tub.
We're standing in front of the building that was sort of, in my opinion anyway, the core of this place back in the 60s. My shop, Roger's shop, which was an old original section off to the left there, and this was a music room, and over there became somebody else's residence, and downstairs was the jazz workshop.
Ed Stiles and I push aside overgrown brush to find the entrance.
This is Roger's lair and where he would be. So it has his spirit in it, and I can see that, but everything else is, you know, the equipment is gone for the most part. The roofs are deteriorated, the floors are sagging, and the whole place is coming down fairly quickly.
In 2006, the Park Service kicked everyone off Druid Heights except those with life estates and their tenants. What remains are memories and buildings crumbling back to the ground.
And this particular building is, unfortunately, getting a little late. So I think we'll probably lose it eventually before too much longer. But it's the end of an era, certainly.
Those who knew Roger Summers say it's a fitting end for his legacy. He lived life as an improvisation, and with improv, once the music is played, it's gone forever. From Druid Heights near Muir Woods in Marin, I'm Judy Silber for Cross Currents.
Find out more of the Druid Heights story and its recognition by the Cultural Landscape Foundation at kalw.org. And that's also where you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter, where you can stay up on what's happening around the Bay Area. The Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Sarah Nora Coast, Angela Johnston, Maggie McKay, Kevin McLean, Lisa Morehouse, True Gwynn, Marissa Ortega Welch, Jessica Plachik, Andrew Seltzer, and Eli Wertschafter. Our engineers are Tariq Foda, James Rollins, and Gabe Graben. Shireen Adil is our content manager. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by composer Danny Clay from San Francisco. He'll provide musical accompaniment to field footage shot across the California coastline tomorrow night at the Center for New Music in San Francisco. Show starts at 7 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. ¶¶